feel to be part of the grand design, the fantastic mosaic of existence. Eh? Are you holding up your end of the spectacular illusion? Up there, man. Don't check it out. Give a little extra shot of mediocrity here.
Oh, gosh almighty. Well, welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Thank you, Laura Ellen Courtner, for that wonderful little insight into Shepherd, or Gene Shepherd. Our engineer is Brian Tilton. Somewhere in the, yeah, it was the mid-80s, I discovered the voice of Gene Shepherd while listening to WAMU's big broadcast. I found him, and I lost him almost right away. He reawakened within me the love of storytelling, and I love to listen to stories. It wasn't until we entered the 21st century that I rediscovered this genius, Gene Shepherd, or Shep, and when I did, I obtained as many of his radio shows, films, and videos as I could. I'd listened to him incessantly, still do. Now, most of you know the work of Shep through the mega hit A Christmas Story, but as you learned in our first Gene Shepherd special, that was December 21st, 2003, I'm sure you remember it well. You took notes, didn't you? Well, his vast accomplishments and genius were far greater and deeper than the film that brought him the wealth and recognition he so long strived for. You know, he wanted to call Christmas Story, The Revenge of Santa. No, Santa's Revenge. Santa's Revenge, yeah, I think that's it. Yeah. Well, to me, Shepherd is one of my great radio heroes, maybe the greatest, which also includes Jack Benny, Bob and Ray, Henry Morgan, Fred Allen, and, well, a lot of others. But he was, and still is, a man of mystery. Who was this genius that entertained me as I passed through some of the darkest and painful years of my life? Huh? Pretty melodramatic there, isn't it? No, it's true. Well, thanks to Gene Bergman, or Eugene Bergman, we now know more about this great soul who inspired and entertained so many thousands. And Gene Bergman, or Bergman that is, started listening to Gene Shepherd in 1956. He says that when Shepherd died in 1999, he realized how important his work is to American culture and began looking further into Shepherd's life and career, which eventually led to the writing of this book that we're going to discuss tonight. Bergman designs and makes artist books, and for 34 years he designed exhibits for the New York City's American Museum of Natural History, and he and his wife and their two sons live in, I'm not going to pronounce this one correctly, but I'll give it a try, Massapequa, New York. That's probably not it, but welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Gene.
Thank you, and you got Massapequa perfectly correctly.
Is that Iroquois country?
Well, it's some kind of Indian country, and a lot of the names out here have American Indian origin. In fact, I'm told that Massapequa means a land of many waters.
Whoa. Wow. That's, I just finished about a week ago my updated book on the Founding Fathers' Secret Societies, and a lot of it is about the League of the Iroquois Indians, and that's why I mentioned that, because I have great respect for what they did for our country and how they influenced the Founding Fathers. Now, you note that Gene Parker Shepherd was at least three people, right? You said this on page 12, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Well, who were they? Who are these three people?
Well, one that most listeners knew was simply the guy that they heard on the radio. Pretty much five nights a week. And they just assumed that this guy who talked to them rather intimately was indeed the Gene Shepherd. Well, he was more of well, somewhat more of a concocted persona. There was also the real, real Gene Shepard that virtually nobody knew about, not even his closest friends.
Yeah.
And then there was the guy that just had a certain image of himself in his mind, and maybe sometimes projected and sometimes didn't. But part of the enigma was that nobody quite knew exactly who Gene Shepard was, even though they may have thought they did.
Well, that's why this book isn't just a normal, straight biography. Is that correct?
Right. In fact, when I first wrote the book, the first couple of versions of the manuscript, the title was Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art of Gene Shepard, because I feel that with any great creator, it's the art that is the most important and, of course, the most enduring thing. However, my publisher asked me to look into people who knew Shepard, people who worked with him, people who were influenced by him, and get some more biographical background, which I did. And now I feel that what I've got is a creative biography. That is the biography of a creative persona. So it's not a strict biography. It's still really focused on the art of Shepard in all media, but it's also got the various aspects of what he was like as a person, at least insofar as people who knew him could figure it out.
That's why it's called The Art and Enigma
yes.
of Gene Shepard. Now, you know, this is perhaps, well, this is not only the most important book that's ever been published on Gene Shepard. Someone would say, of course, well, it's the only anyone that's been published.
Yes.
But you did just an extraordinary job.
Well, thank you.
This is, I was so pleased to learn about the three Gene Shepherds because it confused me considerably over the past. You know, I didn't hear him originally. You did. You had kind of like a personal relationship with him.
Yes, and that's such an extraordinary thing to have been able to turn on the radio at night and await that the announcer saying, and here he is, Gene Shepard, and then you'd hear that theme music that you played at the beginning, and then on would come this voice, and you really had that intimately close feeling of connection to him, and you knew he was just right out there talking to you alone.
You met him. You met him twice?
Well, I talked to him once on the phone very, very briefly, and I really don't remember anything about that except I was exceedingly nervous, and he was polite, and that was it. The other time, he asked people to gather at a bookstore in mid-Manhattan, which we did, and we sort of crowded up the place, and eventually we were asked to leave. So he said, whoever wants to, let's recongregate in the local automat.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, and I had my copy of his hoax book, I, Libertine, and I asked him to sign it. And as I say in the book, I think the conversation in its entirety was something like, Mr. Shepard, would you sign this book? And he probably said, sure, and he signed it, and I took his photo, and the flash went off in his face, and the photo's in the book.
Your parents also like Gene Shepard.
Well, you know, my mother was intrigued by him. I'm not sure how much my father liked him, but they, knowing how much I liked him, when I was away, actually I was in Army training, they would record him for me and send me the tapes. And for me, it was a lifeline to a little bit of intelligent entertainment while I was off there in the Army.
Whoa. That's, you know, I wish my mom and dad would have done that for me. I don't even think they ever heard of Gene Shepard that time. I had one whale of a time trying to remember who he was back there in the mid-'80s the first time I heard him. I think I confused him at first with Henry Morgan. And, of course, you have a wonderful section in here on Henry Morgan that I very much enjoyed as well. Now, as you know, Shep's career reveals the all-too-common tragedy of the innovative artist not sufficiently appreciated in his time. This is a general question about this. Why is it all-too-common for artists such as Gene Shepherd to not be appreciated in their time?
Well, I feel that a great creator is coming up with something that really hasn't been done before or hasn't been done sufficiently well before. And when you do something new, many people don't understand it because they're not familiar with it. They find it strange. It just doesn't appeal to as many people as it should, and eventually one would like to think that history will bear out the truth of the genius of these creators.
And you also, but you point out with Gene Shepherd that he just entered radio at a time period that was most difficult. Is that correct?
That's true also. That's a major reason why I believe he wasn't sufficiently appreciated. Unfortunately, he came on the scene in New York at a time when television was beginning to overwhelm radio, and the old radio networks were falling apart, and sponsors were beginning to put their money in television. So that was a major reason why he did not receive wider renown. Another problem was that rock and roll was coming on and strong. So a lot of radio was beginning to be devoted to it, that is, to music, rather than to what he felt was more important, that is, the sound of the human voice.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, of course, afterwards, on came the big networks, radio networks and satellites and other kinds of media that allowed radio to again gain more power and allowed people to become better known throughout the country. So he missed out on both of those aspects of radio as a medium.
Well, we missed out too. I certainly missed out. When we return, we're going to touch on this storytelling technique that he had from Gene Bergman. The book is Excelsior, You Fathead. Or actually, I should have said Excelsior, You Fathead. That's a little bit better. The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. Applause Theater and Cinema Books. It's available in all major bookstores or by calling 1-800-554-0626. And you better start buying them now, friends, because they're going into their second edition. And I don't... Are they out on... Is the second edition out yet?
I'm told that the second printing will be around in a few days. There are still copies of the first printing out there, but my publisher realized they were running low, so they've rushed the second printing.
Well, we hope to go through about 152 different printings. And when we return, my producer has talking to me there through the window. When we return after this break and a couple of commercials, we're going to hear a two-minute clip on Gene Shepherd on unconscious humor and his opinion of Bob Dylan.
What's happened to everything from Margie? You've been my inspiration. Days are never blue. After all is said and done, there's really only one. Oh, Margie, it's you.
Gene Shepherd, humorist, after-dinner speaker, and recipient of the Mark Twain Award for 1976. Here's Gene.
Now, while we're on the subject of unconscious humor, which you find everywhere, I'm looking at Time magazine, and I'll tell you, you just can't believe it. The unconscious humor that comes out, this ad, it's for a recording scene. And I say not only is this ad a bit of pretty funny stuff, it is also, in a way, a kind of comment on the whole American scheme of things now. And you see this feckless youth And I'll tell you, it doesn't have effect to his name. And you can see he probably hasn't shaved more than four times in his life. At least he has that look. He's standing there by the microphone and looking kind of a little petulant. He's got his guitar and his mouth off, his strap around his neck there. And he's looking out, and he's looking kind of soulful. And on the top there, you see a couple of lines. It says, "How many roads must a man walk down? Bob Dylan has walked down many roads. For most of his 22 long years, he rode freight trains for kicks and got beat up for laughs. Young old-timer who's been there and seen it all and is now looking back over all them old-time friends and those old gals that you just ain't gonna find again. How many roads must a young man walk down before they call him a man? Well, I'd say you got to walk a little more than 22 here, Bob. And actually, I'll tell you, you got to do a little more than walk down a road before they call you a man, actually. That's the sad fact of the matter, son. The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. I call that a pretty good piece of unconscious humor. Friends and neighbors, you know, friends, that I'm not 22 years. And when a man is 22 years, he's just a hitchhiker all the way to Trenton and back. He's taken two trips to Cleveland and once been out to the West Coast. He's seen it. By God, he's seen it.
Well, that was, of course, Gene Shepherd on commentary on one of my favorite people in the world, Bob Dylan, and I think he kind of hit it on the head down there. Our guest is Gene Bergman. The book is Excelsior. Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. Applause, Theater, and Cinema Books. Available in all major bookstores or by calling 1-800-554-0626. Visit the website FlickLives.com. Gosh, well, he is a captivating talker. Tell us about his technique.
His technique was to, as I said, be extremely intimate. He had this ability to just talk as though, the way I like to put it, you're either in a dorm late at night having a fascinating conversation on all kinds of things, or maybe you're in a bar late at night, you know, the Frank Sinatra song, it's 2:45, there's no one in the place except you and me, and I've got a story I got to tell, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you had that feeling with Shepherd that he was indeed engaging with you in a dialogue on the most fascinating subjects that you just had all these great ideas about, and he did, and that you were both communicating. Of course, he was a great conversationalist. The problem is I like to say, he was the only one doing the talking. But he gave you the impression that it was something just between you and him.
Can you imagine sitting in a restaurant with him and Bob and Ray and having him dominate that conversation? That must have been incredible.
Well, you're probably referring to that photograph of the book.
Sure.
I think it's really funny. You know, Bob and Ray, great talkers on the radio, and there they are with Gene Shepherd, and wouldn't you know, it's Shepherd who's doing the talking in the photo.
It almost looks like they're cowering in the corner. I know that's not what happened, but, I mean, the image, there are so many good photos here within this book. And that makes a world of difference, especially when you want to see Gene in his many, maybe 10, 12 different disguises over the period of, how many years did he live, 79?
Yes, he died at 78 in 1999.
78, yeah. And, of course, he didn't like rock and roll very much. As a matter of fact, he predicted its death.
You know, several times he said, well, it's not going to last. You know, I can see it's over the hill now. And, everyone is has a little wishful thinking on some subject, I suppose. And that was a big error on his part. Of course, part of the reason, as I say, that he hated it is because it tended to dominate his medium.
Yeah, sure. And, of course, he'd love to dominate conversation. And I'm glad he was like that, because I think it was part of his growth and development. Now, the importance, Gene knew some very, very renowned musicians, very renowned, especially in the area of jazz, and you discussed that. As a matter of fact, I should have mentioned, of course, earlier on that there were some very influential people that have been influenced by Gene Shepherd. You note Billy Collins, Hugh Hefner, Jules Feiffer, Larry Josephson, Andy Kaufman, Barry Farber, and Joe Franklin, Shel Silverstein, Charlie Mingus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Gene had a special relationship with the Beats and musicians at that time, and he inculcated it especially in his earlier shows. Is that correct?
Yes, his early shows especially were very much jazz-based. Not only did he play a lot of jazz on his early shows, but his very technique of improvisation was based on or influenced by the idea of jazz being in an improvisation, where you'd start out with a theme, you'd move away from it, you'd do variations on it, and probably come back to it in the end. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of improvisation going on at that time, especially in New York in the 50s, which was a very creative period for all of the arts. There was, of course, Jack Kerouac, whom Shepherd knew in writing, and there was the bebop phase of jazz, which had a lot of improvisation in it. And Shepherd was a very close friend for a while of Charles Mingus, the jazz bassist, and he even did a recording with Mingus called The Clown. And he wrote articles for jazz magazines, and he was just really into it. It was a very important part of his life.
The only Broadway hit that I've ever... Well, actually, not the only... The first Broadway hit that I ever saw in New York City was A Thousand Clowns.
Oh, yeah.
And there's an interesting story in your work. I'm trying to look at all the other questions I put down here, trying to recall the name of the individual that he was very close with, Gene Shepherd, and actually worked with him on a record before.
The author of A Thousand Clowns was Herb Gardner.
That's right, Herb Gardner. And they got along very well. But when I saw that film, as you noted, that there's some kind of link between Gene Shepherd's life and this film. Is that correct?
Yes. The main character, played by Jason Robards, has a lot of the attributes of Shepherd. He was a nonconformist. One of the main little bits in the film was the playing of and singing of Yes Sir, That's My Baby. Well, that was a favorite Shepherd song. Shepherd liked to do something called hurl invectives. That is, make this wild statement out into the night through the loudspeakers of thousands of listeners. Well, the Robards character does something very similar and two instances. He opens his window and yells up the air shaft to whatever unsuspecting neighbors might happen to hear him. Another time he gets up early in the morning when obviously everybody's asleep, and he just yells out the equivalent of an invective. Now, all of this, I think Shepherd probably liked. What I don't think Shepherd liked, and what I think ended the friendship, is that the play in the film ends with the Shepherd character conforming. That is, he realizes that in order to save his relationship with the woman he cares about and to retain his nephew with him instead of the nephew being sent away, he has to get a job, he has to wear a suit, he has to go running for the commuter bus. And the film, indeed, ends with him in mid-commuter stride, as I like to say, as though he were pinned to the screen like a moth. And I think that's probably what Shepherd objected to, and several people told me it totally ended the friendship between the author, Herb Gardner, and Shepherd.
Did the lawsuit that started, was it ever finished, or was it just...
Well, you know, I don't know if it's true or not that there was a lawsuit. What I do know is that Shepherd claimed that he instituted a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you repeat frequently, many of the things that he claimed are quite questionable, in regards especially to his saying and making the statement that what he wrote was fiction, all fiction. But you did some primary research, and what you learned was maybe not all of it. Is that right?
Well, it's interesting that he liked to have things two ways. On the radio, most people who listened to him assumed that what he told, his stories, were true, that they really happened to him.
I did.
And he allowed people to feel that way. On the other hand, when he wrote his book, that is a compilation of some of those stories, he's got the typical author disclaimer saying that it's all fiction. And a lot of people were very upset by that because they had been assuming it was true. But at that point, he felt that if everyone thought all he was doing was remembering stuff, what kind of great creator is that? Well, he wanted people to feel that he had created it all out of his mind. Well, the truth is somewhere in between. Many of the character names that he used are the names of real people that he knew.
Mm-hmm.
Whether the details of the stories were true or not, we'll probably never know exactly.
Yeah. Well, we do know that there was a person named Flick and a few others, as you pointed out, by going to his yearbook.
Right.
And they spelled his name wrong, as you will.
Well, which is an incredible irony.
Yeah.
With Shepherd.
Yeah, indeed. I think it's H. They spelled it H-A-R-D.
No. Right.
Yes, H-A-R-D, something like that. Oh, your notes section is just terrific. I know that our listeners that are going to buy your book aren't necessarily going to focus on the notes section, but to many who really want to know where you get information, I'm glad you did this and took the time.
I tell people that maybe in some books the notes are just kind of some added little detail that's not very important, but I try to make my notes give you some information, intriguing information that I didn't want to break up the main flow of the book, but that is really interesting unto itself.
Yeah, well, that makes a very big difference to anyone who really wants to find it. Obviously, when you did this work, how many years did it take you? You decided somewhere after 1999 when he died that you were going to write it.
Right.
Did you begin right away?
Well, what I did was I started talking to people about Shepherd. There's an email chat group devoted to Shepherd, and I began, as I was listening to more and more of his shows on tape, I began to comment on Shepherd and just think spend a lot of my time thinking about him, what he was doing on the radio, his different techniques, the different aspects of his creative life. And I started putting notes into file folders, and before I knew it, I saw that these file folders could be organized into the kind of book that I knew really should be written about a guy like this. And I started writing in the spring of 2000.
Well, I'm sure that you did this just to make a lot of money, right?
Well, ha.
Yeah, I know.
Believe me, if I were a professional author, I would never have spent the 4 or 5 years from when I started writing the book until finally we have it published. I would never have done that. I couldn't have made any money. No professional author is going to do that. They'll try to get a contract to write a book. Well, I didn't. I just knew I needed to write this book, because of what Shepard was and what he meant to me and to American culture. And I just went about it, and I wrote it, and then I looked for a publisher. And that took a while, but eventually they found me, interestingly. So I
was
very fortunate.
I had a very similar experience with the Beatles Yellow Submarine book. The Beatles weren't that interested in publicizing that great film. We're going to take a break and award a copy of Gene Bergman's Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard, Applause Theater and Cinema Books, available in all major bookstores by calling 1-800-554-0626, 1-800-554-0626, and check out the website Flick, F-L-I-C-K, lives.com, flicklives.com. And coming up after the commercial, we are going to hear a little speech to the hometown of Hammond, Indiana, in regards to Gene Shepard. Oops, nope, we got to change. A recent bulletin. The bulletin says, going into the 8:40 break after this commercial, we're going to have a minute and a half with Gene Shepard from a live presentation in the 1980s at his hometown in Holman, Indiana, explaining the town. That's the town he wrote about in A Christmas Story. It's kind of a mythical composite town. All of that from my producer. Excelsior, you fathead. That's Excelsior, you fathead.
Because for years I've been writing and doing television and movies and one thing or another about a mythical town. And don't forget, I write about a mythical town. I don't write about him. You must understand that. So, listen carefully, you might learn something about my writing. I write about a town which I call Holman, Indiana. Not based on the street of Holman, but a mythical town that is a composite of all these northern Indiana towns. Beautiful downtown Whiting. East Chicago in the dusk. Indiana Harbor in the fly season. And all these towns, you see, I have put into a composite town. And it's like Faulkner with it, creating a composite Mississippi town, which he created, so I created the southern or this Indiana town. It's a fiction. Now, I have had people, and my story is a fiction too, by the way, and I've had people who swear they remember when certain things happen, which really scares me. that makes me wonder about the whole study of history. The composite, when you're creating fiction, now, how many of you saw A Christmas Story? Well, that never happened, you know.
Yes, well, this is 21st Century Radio. We'll talk about Christmas Story in a little while, perhaps next hour. With our guest, Gene Bergman, Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard, Applause Theater and Cinema Books, available in all major bookstores, or by calling 1-800-554-0626, website flicklives.com. Now, those who had the privilege of seeing Shep at work were surprised at how he did his show in the studio. What surprised them?
Well, he never had a script, and numerous people told me that. They would say that, well, they'd see him with a teeny scrap of paper, which maybe had a word or two on, that would just remind him of what kind of story or subject he wanted to talk about. Or maybe he'd go in with a couple of news clippings that he wanted to make a commentary on. But he never, ever had a script, even though in the early days he was on for hours and hours at a time. Now, a couple of people who knew him told me that on occasion he would start talking to them not on the radio, but just to them personally, and they'd tune into his radio show that evening, and they would find some of the same stuff that he'd just been telling off the cuff to them. So in a sense, he would sometimes do a little bit of a rehearsal, a little riff on what he thought he would be talking about that night on the radio.
Well, many see in Gene's work a nostalgia for the good old days. How did he react to that misconception?
Well, he constantly said that he hated nostalgia because he said, well, the past wasn't so good, you know, and the future isn't necessarily going to be good either.
Yeah.
You know, just live in the present is what he said. On the other hand, there were some nostalgic bits in his work, especially in some of his TV films, and indeed there's a nostalgic sense about his movie A Christmas Story. But all of these millions and millions of people that watch it every year at Christmas time and think of it so nostalgically, I have to tell them that, yes, there are nostalgic elements, but there are, a half a dozen different little episodes that happen in that film that are pretty much the opposite of nostalgia. In other words, you really wouldn't want life to have been like that.
Yeah.
My favorite is when little Ralphie goes to tell Santa what he wants, and he's about to go down the slide having forgotten, and he says, I want a BB gun for Christmas. And Santa says, you'll shoot your eye out, kid. And Santa lifts up his big black boot and literally shoves this 10-year-old kid back down the chute by pushing him in the face with his big black boot. Now, that's not exactly a nostalgic image of Santa Claus and Christmas.
No, it isn't. And as you point out, that when he changed that in other versions, or had to change it. No. That was in the window at Macy's.
Yes.
When they had that. Yeah.
I think it's funny that last year, Macy's on Herald Square in mid-Manhattan, which always does very elaborate animated scale models of some Christmas scenes, all of the main Herald Square windows were devoted to A Christmas Story, and the one of little Ralphie and Santa, they don't show Santa pushing little Ralphie down. They show one of Santa's assistants, and as I comment, certainly Macy Santa does not exhibit such antisocial behavior, so they couldn't show Santa pushing Ralphie down the slide.
Well, Shep saw blandness foisted on America by the media and the mediocre, but he was amused by the widespread oddballness and funkiness, as you point out. How did he present this in his various shows?
Well, he had something that he called straws in the wind, which were usually little news notes, not the big major things stressed across the front page of your newspaper, but the little notes down in the corners. And he liked to say that sometimes you can learn a lot about human nature and about maybe what the new trends are by noting some of these kooky little things down in the corner of the newspaper. And another aspect of that was trivia. And he would also say that sometimes trivia isn't very trivial. And also he referred to cracks in the sidewalk, which I think is a really interesting image, because one of the things he said was it was tough being a kid.
Yeah.
You know, adults think, oh, what wonderful days of childhood. And Shepard said, it wasn't so great. You know, you ask any kid, is this really great being a kid? And most kids wouldn't say, no, it's not great. It's just what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course some of the that one particular part in I've forgotten which film it is right now, but certainly Marcus, Scott Farkas.
Yes.
Right, Scott Farkas. I always thought it was Scott, but Scott Farkas that top match that they had, in which the very best that Gene could do as a child, was to tie and not win.
Right, the murderous Mariah was the top that the other guy had, that Scott had, and Gene, or really Ralphie, the Gene Shepherd kid, gets into a top fight with this kid, kind of nasty kid, who had the best top in the neighborhood, and the tops whirled around each other and knocked into each other, and the final result was not one or the other winning, but both of them ending up down the drain, down the sewer drain, and lost forever. And that was sort of typical of what Shepherd would do. He'd tell this fascinating, funny story, and it wouldn't necessarily have one of these nice, pleasant endings.
He
put a little turn on it, a twist on it.
And it wasn't, as you point out, until some of the films, like A Christmas Story or another areas that he had on television, et cetera, that he became more positive along those lines. And it's certainly one of the things that I want to get to next hour deals with, of course. He ran into trouble in radio. After spending 22 years on radio, a good part of it, WOR, did he have 17 years there at WOR?
Yeah, actually, that entire 22 years was at WOR. He was at other stations in Cincinnati and Philadelphia before that.
Well, he ran into some serious problems, and we're going to close tonight's show dealing with one of Barry Farber's comments in regards to how Shep could have avoided all of that. When we return with Gene Bergman, Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd, Applause Theater and Cinema Books, and available in all major bookstores by calling 1-800-554-0626. FlickLives.com. I'm getting different signals from my producer in here. You mean that I still have a little bit of time here? Indeed. My heavens. No, we don't. As a matter of fact, we have 9 seconds, I understand, unless my clock is correct in here. So there's no use in discussing that. It's called a Mercury retrograde moment. We'll be back next hour.
Better and better, and then came the cold gray light of dawn the next morning. And I am still sitting here, untattooed, unmarked, and somewhere Esther Jane is spinning forever her own life. Praise be to the Lord. The way it later turned out. Oh, man, that was a close one.
Please, you've got 45 minutes to reset that. Before you do that, I want some sweet, beautiful, how fantastically in love I am with myself music. Now, once again, this is Mr. Chucky reporting with a brief note from the world of narcissism. Oh, this is so lovely. Oh, I love ballet. I should have been a dancer. Inside me, there is a light nymph flying ever and ever on gauzy diaphanous wings. Now we have, it's nice, it's
Tonight's milestone in the world of narcissism, we have this lovely note which comes from a shampoo advertiser.
Well, welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Our executive producer and research assistant for the past 17 years is Laura Courtner. Our engineer is Brian Tilton. And there goes Gene Shepard. My gosh, he certainly woke me up and put me back to sleep again last night. Yes, indeed. Now, our guest, of course, is Gene Bergman. The book is Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard, applause theater and cinema books. By the way, at the bottom of the hour, let me give you the phone number before I do that. It's available in all major bookstores, of course, and you should call 1-800-554-0626, and the website is flicklives.com. At the bottom of the hour, Jeff Beauchamp of the Gene Shepard Project is going to stop by to tell you how you can obtain free CDs and MP3s of Shep's shows. Wow. How did Shep's humor differ from the other seriously funny comics like Mort Saul and the others?
Well, they all pretty much made it big in the late 50s, early 60s, and their humor or their comedy tended to be more topical, especially someone like Mort Saul, who would talk about things that happened that day in politics, etc. And they were very funny guys, but Shepard felt that his humor, which he differentiated from comedy, was longer lasting because it dealt with the human condition. He was very funny, but he didn't depend on a laugh every 8 or 10 seconds as he claimed these other seriously funny comics did. And I think it's interesting that those other people are no longer doing their stand-up bits on television, and you don't really think of them anymore, and you probably can't even remember much of anything that they ever said except the general feeling, while Shepard had tens of thousands of fans who were so devoted to his programs because he did deal in more universal human activities. And as I say, he was very, very funny, but and you sort of laughed inwardly a lot rather than coming out with a big belly laugh every 10 seconds. But he, I like to say, tickled the better parts of your mind. You know, he made you laugh on an intellectual level. You'd say, boy, yeah, he's really, really right about that.
Well, he certainly was right about one particular. He was doing an interview. He traveled with the Beatles back in 1964, I believe it was. And I think his insights into the Beatles and how they treated others is clearly, it's a great piece of humor, but at the same time, it's a hell of a statement. Did you enjoy that?
Yes. What's interesting is that Shepard did not like rock and roll. He put down Dylan and the Beatles, and yet Playboy sent him over to the British Isles to travel around with the Beatles for a week. And one would have expected that he'd come back and do the interview, which appeared in February 65, do the interview in Playboy, and it would be a big put-down. Well, it really wasn't. What he found was that they were four really nice guys, really regular guys, and he seemed to get to appreciate them as people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot to appreciate there, as far as I'm concerned, about their being some of the finest people that ever lived on this planet in some ways, especially what they did with their money and how they've helped a lot of other individuals in their consciousness. Now, the Gene was fired on... I think it was in 1956 he was fired from WOR Radio. How did his night people come to his rescue?
Well, yes, he was fired twice within a very short period. First of all, he was considered non-commercial. Well, if you're on from 1 in the morning to 5:30 in the morning, you're not going to attract too many big advertisers. So, and he didn't. And because he was considered by the WOR administration as being non-commercial, they wanted to maybe try out something else. So he knew he was about to leave, and he said to his listeners, you know, you guys out there, my listeners, you buy things too. Let's prove that my listeners spend money on stuff. Let's go out, and he said, let's all ask for Sweetheart soap. And as soon as the general manager heard this, they cut him off the air immediately. Well, there was a big uproar from his listeners. And indeed, Sweetheart Soap said, we'll sponsor him, which is really funny. He also was fired for not playing enough music. And this happened to him several times in Cincinnati and Philadelphia, or at least one of those places, before he got to New York. And, of course, everyone was playing music. And his manager, general manager, said, we want you to play more music. And Shepard claimed that he responded, everybody plays music. They want to hear the human voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the general manager said, if you don't play more music tonight, you're out of here. Well, he didn't play one little bit of music that night. He just talked, and again, he was cut off the air. Well, his fans would gathered in nonviolent milling throngs to protest. So eventually, WOR asked him to come back. In fact, he was hiding out somewhere, and it took them several days to find him. They would broadcast, oh, Gene Shepard, please come back. We want you back. And eventually he came back, and they gave him a time slot on Sunday nights from 9 to 1.
But where was he hiding? Do you know?
Well, somebody told me he was hiding at a psychiatrist's house, I think up in Connecticut. Now, I don't have any firm basis for knowing whether that's true or not, but he just felt that that if he stayed out of the way for a little bit, the enthusiasm of his fans would grow and the anxiety of WOR would grow, and it would result in something good. And, of course, it did.
Well, in your book, you talk about the appreciation that he showed towards his fans. I think it was did he take a whole show and thank them, because he basically said that without them, he wouldn't be on the air there.
Yes, this is very strange, because you would not have expected Gene Shepard, the ultimate narcissist and egomaniac that he was, to do this. But I was delighted when I did find this one tape, which I quote extensively in the book, in which he says that he realizes that it was his fans supporting him that got him back on the air after he was fired. He also said that, you know, when you do something that's unusual, like improvisation, doesn't necessarily always come out well. But my fans have stood by me. You know, they figure if they're not too excited about a couple of minutes of what I'm doing, they know that the next thing is going to be something that will fascinate them. And he appreciated that they stuck with him. And he also appreciated, surprisingly, that some of his sponsors stuck with him. And he said, you know, there's no free art. When you go to a theater, you put down your hard cash to see one of the great plays. They don't let you in for nothing. So you have to expect that on the radio, too. And he said he really appreciated that his sponsors stuck with him.
And as time went on, he had so many sponsors.
Yes, that was an irony.
Yeah.
You know, the more popular he got so many sponsors, it would break up the continuity of his so-called long form of storytelling and humor. They would tend to break the mood, or you know, what he would tend to do is to cluster the sponsors up in one section so that it'd be 10 or 12 minutes or more of nothing but commercials to get them out of the way so that he could have his time to do his thing.
I think you pointed out that at one time 18 minutes was commercials.
Yes.
That's a long time to cut out of a 45-minute show.
Right.
And so, of course, that meant that obviously he didn't have 45 minutes, but maybe 20-some minutes, and that can be very frustrating, especially when he read some of his stories, which would take about 40-some minutes to read.
Right. Well, he occasionally, the only time I know of that he literally read any of his stories on the air was at Christmas time after the story about the kid wanting the BB gun became well known. Sometimes instead of telling that story extemporaneously, he would literally read that. But that was not the norm for him. He did not read stories on the air.
He was not so happy about A Christmas Story, was he?
Well, he liked the idea that it was a movie and that he was getting widespread exposure, but I don't think a movie was really the kind of thing that he would have preferred to do. I think if only radio had been kinder to him at the time he was on it. I believe that was his best medium, and I think anything else he did, although he enjoyed very much and he did good work, I think it kind of upset him ultimately, and he became rather bitter about not having achieved greater renown in radio and other fields.
22 years at WOR, maybe 4 or 5 years at Cincinnati and other places. That's a long time on the radio, and he ends up leaving radio in 1977.
Yeah.
When we return, let's find out how that happened, and then take a look at Gene Shepherd's career as far as other products, such as books and movies and other types of TV production, which I just absolutely love. I've worn out my audio videotapes already by watching some of these various shows. We'll be back with our guest, Gene Bergman, Excelsior You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd, Applause Theater and Cinema Books, available in all major bookstores, calling, by the way, you should call, 1-800-554-0626, flicklives.com. And coming up after the commercial break, we're going to have a 2-minute clip from Gene Shepherd on the Hollow Earth Theory. He gives you some idea of his take on the paranormal.
This is the 1964 New York World's Fair. It's in September now, and we're just about nearing the end of the first year of this enormous celebration. Or let us say we are about at the point now where the first fatheads are beginning to leave the party and the hardcore regulars are beginning to drink steadily. And it's, let us say, beginning to shake down. You can hear the Mexicans now warming up in the background. I'm often curious about what some of these people think of world fairs, the places they work, and the people they sing for. They look like real Mexicans. They're wearing Mexican costumes. They're wearing Mexican headgear, and they're even singing Mexican music. But they're probably singing Straight Boredom Road. We'll be back out here at the Mexican Pavilion to round up the whole scene. And now let's move on to the next enormous vision in this giant kaleidoscope, this peculiar shifting mosaic of human partydom, the New York World's Fair. Hang on.
Seltzer bottle, you slob.
It's the 20th century. We're right in the middle of it. Man is tearing away the curtains of doubt, right? He's battering down the bulwarks of ignorance, right? And yet, underneath it all, he suspects there is something afoot. Listen to this one now, for example. This is an advertisement from a top New York City newspaper. In a big dynamic heading, it says, "Revealed. The underground world of supermen discovered by Admiral Byrd under the North Pole and kept secret by the U.S. government." A noted scholar and author of The Hollow Earth says that the true home of the flying saucers is a huge underground world whose entrance is at the North Pole opening. In the hollow interior of the Earth lives a super race which wants nothing to do with man on the surface. They launched their flying saucers only after man threatened the world with A-bombs. Admiral Byrd, says this scholar, led a Navy team into the polar opening and came upon this underground region. It's free of ice and snow. Has mountains covered with forests, lakes, rivers, vegetation, and strange animals. But the news of the discovery was suppressed by the U.S. government in order to prevent other nations from exploring the inner world and claiming it. The rotten government. And now, Dr. Bernard leads you through this subterranean world to meet the civilization which occupies an underground area larger than North America. Beneath the 800-mile crust of the Earth is the greatest discovery in human history, inhabited by millions of super-intelligent beings. If you are ready for information that not many people can handle, order this book today. Different.
Oh. There are so many things about Gene Shepard that Gene Shepard and I do not agree on. especially about chiropractic medicine and everything like that. But he is such a great storyteller that I just love to listen to. He's the only individual I've ever heard of on the radio that talked about Bertrand Russell. Now, Bertrand Russell, my listeners know, was my god. I was a logical positivist. I mean, whatever Bertrand Russell used to say had to be right. And Gene Shepard had some very interesting things to say in regards to Bertrand Russell. And we're going to talk, well, I'm not going to talk about that, but we're going to talk about more about Gene Shepard from the book Excelsior, You Fathead. And yes, of course, the author is Gene Bergman. And, of course, have you ever thought of the name relationship there on the first name basis?
It's inevitable.
Yeah, of course. Of course, you spell your name differently.
Yes, and of course, my name is, the full name is Eugene, but most people call me Gene, so there's sort of a nice coincidence there with Gene Shepard and Gene Bergman.
Oh, Gene's story on his kindergarten days and his teacher calling him Eugene, et cetera, was just brilliant. Brilliant stuff. Well, let me finish with the title of the book. That's Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard, Applause, Theater, and Cinema Books, available at all major bookstores or by calling 1-800-554-0626. Go to the website flick, F-L-I-C-K, .com. Well, after, the time in radio, Shep had won the award, the Mark Twain Award in 1976, and by 1977, it was all over for him at WOR. What brought about the end of Shep's radio career?
He was actually beginning to move away from it a little bit because he was so involved in his television work, upcoming movies, his writing, and so on. So he was starting to record some of his shows in the last year that he was on WOR. However, WOR at that point, beginning of 1977, decided that they wanted to change the station a bit. And one of the things that they did was they got rid of the whole nighttime block of people who talked. Of course, the others didn't talk like Shepard. But, for example, the Times reported that John Wingate, WOR reporter for 30 years, Stan Lomax, a sports commentator for 43 years, Henry Gladstone, a newscaster for 32 years, and Gene Shepard, famous for his impressionistic nostalgia monologues, as they put it, have all resigned and will leave within 2 weeks. Well, they resigned because their arms were twisted by management. So it was a combination of Gene getting a little bit further afield in his work and WOR at the same time just deciding to change what they were doing because I think they were losing out to so many stations playing rock and roll, etc.
Yes, I did want to note the advice that Barry Farber, if he thought that Gene Shepherd wanted to stay in radio, what he should have done. What kind of success did Gene expect when he first started in this work?
When Shepherd was growing up, radio was the medium. This is, we're talking about growing up in the 20s and 30s, and there were great newscasters. The voices were memorable, just as somebody giving the news, such as Henry Gladstone. There were many original plays on the radio, and many Broadway plays were broadcast, redone as radio programs. Of course, there was Orson Welles with his War of the Worlds broadcast. And there were so many exciting things going on in radio, and Shepherd felt that he could do great work also, which he did. The problem was, as I said, the television was coming in, and rock and roll was tending to dominate radio, and what he believed was the potential for radio was never fulfilled to his satisfaction, and he became very frustrated.
Well, after leaving radio, you know, he became very bitter. He cut off his relationships with those who worked within in radio and continued on in TV, writing films besides The Christmas Story. Which, as I noted before, he and you said, Santa's Revenge is what he'd like to have called it. What were among his best in all of his creative works in regards to outside of radio? Because I love his radio work the best.
Well, one of the things that I think he did that was extraordinary on television was a series, two series of half-hour programs called Gene Shepherd's America.
Yeah.
These were done for PBS. There was a series of 12 and then another roughly 10. These were done in 1971 and then in 1985. What he did was to just get out a map of the United States and ask his producers and director, where do you want to go? What should we talk about America? And they would just decide and go there with a very small crew of lightweight video equipment that had just recently been developed, so you could indeed take it along with you. And he did many of these programs in an improvising way. Now, can you imagine today producers and sponsors saying, okay, you've got a half hour on television, just go and do what you want without a script. Well, I think this took a tremendous amount of courage,
mm-hmm.
and he did it. Not all the shows are great masterpieces, but he was doing something that was attempting to show the vast, fascinating variety of America. And as I say, if he could have done, say, 500 of these, he would have had the most extraordinary composite documentary of American culture. Well, he had a bit of it. He did something like 23, and I really admire his courage in doing it that way and making the attempt to express his feelings about the America he loved.
Well, thank you for that section on the special sections listing all of his productions, whether it be in the print media or the electronic media. And I had I've been trying to locate some of the other video productions. I just don't think that some of them were reproduced.
No, most of them are locked in the vaults of PBS in Boston, and National Public Radio has some stuff, and some of these you find available for sale here and there, but of course a lot of people would like to see them rebroadcast.
I sure would.
You can see some of them on if you go to the Museum of Television and Radio. There's they have one location in Midtown Manhattan and another one in California. They have some Shepard material in various media.
Well, I note that you've written a full-length one-man play in four scenes about Shepard.
Yes. In between working on the book, I decided that this was another area that I could express some of my ideas about Shepard, about the great potential he had, how he moved through the great phases of his radio work and expanded into other media. And unfortunately, the tragedy was that he realized that he had not achieved what he wanted to. He hadn't, maybe in some ways, been the kind of person he should have been and could have been. And he was very sad at the end of this play, but I, being an optimist, have him finally accept the inevitable, the good and the bad and the ugly, and he conducts a final performance of his theme music, which is kind of the ultimate piece of glop music, as he liked to put it. Corny, but fascinating also. This is the Bond-free opening theme and closing theme. And he conducts it at the end of the play, and it shows that he's been reconciled to all aspects of his life.
Well, I certainly think he would be happy with that. Thank you ever so much, Gene Bergman. Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard, Applause Theater and Cinema Books, available in all major bookstores or by calling 1-800-554-0626. Please go to the website flicklives.com. Thank you very much, Gene.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it more than you did. So now our guest, when we come back, as a matter of fact, Jeff Beauchamp of the Gene Shepard Project stops by to tell you how you can obtain free CDs and MP3s of Shep's shows.
Your tent, I'll creep, all the stars that shine above. Walk the light our way to love. You'll roll this land with me.
Gene Shepard, humorist, after-dinner speaker, and recipient of the Mark Twain Award for 1976. Here's Gene.
Get this now. This is right here in the heart of good old friendly Manhattan. And you, of course, are aware that the street department, and get this, Jack, the street department is still maintaining hunting teams who spend their nights hunting throughout the water supply system of New York, dark, deep under the subways, way down under your feet, hunting alligators. Do you know that there are alligators living right under the surface of Manhattan? Everyone says, oh, no, it can't be. Oh, yes, it is. And you know where they came from? There was a tremendous fad, if you remember a few years ago, people buying alligators and sending them back from Florida. You remember those? For a dollar and sending them back to Cousin Mim in the Bronx? Yes. Well, what happened after you have an alligator around the house for a while and you get kind of tired of the look on its face? And what do you do with an alligator? You don't throw them out, you know, you just toss them out in the garbage. Well, what happened with most people is it's a funny little thing. Yes, they wound up in the water supply. Guess how? But the thing about an alligator, baby, is that he's amphibious. And more than that, he's highly adaptable. And that water supply system down under the streets of New York is kept at a constant temperature, you know. It does not freeze down there. And so they grew to great size until this very day, right under your feet, 14-foot alligators are stalking. And little men with little lights on their helmets are looking for them. Just thought you ought to know.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. After all, well, as a matter of fact, I tried to locate a lot of other tapes that I knew were available in videotapes and TV shows and film productions of my own, and I flubbed it. Until I got to the web and found FlickLives.com, and it was there that I struck pay dirt, locating the Gene Shepherd Project, formerly called Fathead Central. Fathead Central. The Gene Shepherd Project is, well, it has an enormous archive and an extremely rare and honorable attitude about sharing their material for absolutely no charge. I know it sounds impossible, but it does happen sometimes. Our next guest is a man 90% responsible, I understand, from the Gene, or for the Gene Shepherd Project, and that's Jeff Beauchamp, who also joined us on the air. That was back there on December 21st, 2003. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Jeff.
Oh, thank you, Bob.
Jeff, you had a chance to. Have you had a chance to read Bergman's Excelsior, you fathead?
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
Oh, it's fabulous.
Isn't it?
I think that, you know, I think there's one point that might be missed about Gene's book, and that is if you were a Shepherd fan, you probably have the book and probably, like me, read it two or three times already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think, as an American author, I think his life and his work are fascinating, and I think that it would appeal to somebody that perhaps never got a chance to hear Shepherd on the air.
Well, it appeals to me in a lot of ways. One way being that Shepherd was a creative genius and artist in many different areas, and he struggles like so many other artists that are a bit ahead of their time, you know, like decades ahead of their time. It does cause some serious trouble with our culture. It really does. Tell us about the Gene Shepherd Project.
It started out when I was in high school, around 1972, when a group of myself and some friends would listen to Shepherd, and a couple of us managed to scrape together enough money to buy tape recorders, and then we would start taping Shep's shows off the air, and then we would trade them, and then we would encounter other kids who either taped the shows or wanted to listen to them. So we would make copies of tapes, or we would trade tapes with other people, and well, it's actually a long story, but to make it short, it's kind of blossomed over the years, and when we finally got a computer and got on the web, then things really broke loose. We started converting the tapes that we had into MP3 files, and we were sharing them on Napster, when Napster was actually something that you might want to get involved with. And that led to, because I had a very slow internet connection, a dial-up connection, it was very hard for people to get these files because they were rather large. So people would ask if we could put them on CD-ROMs and just send them via snail mail so we wouldn't tie up our computers. And that seemed like a very good idea. And then thanks to Jim Clavin, who runs the FlickLives.com site, he gave us what Shep fans would call a crummy commercial on his website, and that attracted more people. But especially it attracted people who also had tapes, which is really what we're looking for. And they got in touch with us, and we would borrow their tapes and make copies of them and, again, convert them to MP3s. And we would compile these on CD-ROMs. And then we would give them away, basically, to people who wanted to hear Shepherd again. And it's still going on to this day.
How do people get started? How do they find, or how are they able to obtain these MP3s?
You can, well, it's a little difficult now. You can, I guess you can find a couple of web pages on Jim's site, www.flicklives.com. It's hard to get there from the home page now, but if you just do a Google search for the Gene Shepherd Project, there's various ways where you can get to the site. We're actually coming out with our own site probably within the next 30 days to be called, naturally enough, the GeneShepherdProject.com. I've already got the domain name and a web host. I just have to create the content for it and get it up there. But if they contact us that way, or you can send an email to shepmp3@aol.com. And, you know, just ask us for the details of how we do this, and I'll send an email back and, you know, describe what we do. And that's how they can get in touch with us.
So it's Shep.
If you were going to a rock concert and you're sitting there before the show and you're getting a little antsy, you know, because you want your favorite band to come out. Well, it was kind of like that to listen to Shepherd. You never knew what he was going to say. Most of the time it was interesting, to say the least. Very rarely did I ever find that Shepherd did a boring show. I mean, occasionally he would delve into a subject that I didn't particularly care about, let's say maybe sports. I'm not a big sports fan. But, you know, as Gene mentioned earlier, all right, so maybe there was one night he spent 45 minutes talking about the Mets. But you knew, like, tomorrow he would be talking about the sea cow that lived in the house down the street, you know, or something like that. So there was a great sense of anticipation when, you know, waiting for that trumpet call to come on. And even for us that were, you know, started listening when we were young and we had to hide the transistor radio under the pillow so our parents wouldn't find out we were up much later than we really should have been.
Did you catch his earliest shows? That is, like, from 56 to the 61, those areas?
I'm far too young for that. Actually, I got introduced to Shepherd probably right in the middle of the 60s when my father was a fan. And there would be occasions when, let's say, maybe we were in the family car and we were coming back from a relative's house or something, and he would put Shepherd on the radio. And then we were allowed, like, officially to listen to him. But, my experience with Shep goes back to about the middle 60s.
Well, Shep's Army Tales, it's interesting. I think his Army Tales, there are so many of them, were a more direct confrontation between the adult world and the individual and how... And how did these tales expose, well, a more dismal and depressing side of things in regards to Gene?
In regards to Gene, well, I don't know if I can speak about that. I mean, he spoke about Army life itself as being incredibly boring. That seemed to be the main component of his Army experience, occasionally punctuated by maybe night maneuvers or playing practical jokes on the lieutenant by putting fireworks into the radar set that they were assigned to maintain. But I don't know.
There were many that the troop train Ernie, and that one, I think, geez a whiz, the thing that I enjoyed so much about that was I thought that I knew what was going to happen, as you do with many of Gene's tales, but the way it unfolded was just extraordinary.
Well, yeah, I mean, as far as the way Gene told his stories, let's say sometimes I want to describe a show to somebody, I could probably summarize the show in a lot of cases in maybe a sentence or two, but that was not the beauty of Gene's work. It was all the details, all the fleshing out that he did in order to get from point A to point B. That's not to say that in many of his stories, he got to the end, and, you know, you were often very surprised by the turn of events that occurred. But it was more in the details, the way he told the story, I think.
And I, so many times, was challenging his audience, which I guess at the same time was challenging his engineer or his to-be wife, Lee Brown.
Lee Brown, right?
Brown, boy.
Yeah, they were his audience on the other side of the glass. He needed attention from them. And if they didn't pay attention, he could be pretty cruel to them.
His radio technique may have something to do with, at least Gene Bergman noted that something to do with his interest in ham radio.
Oh, absolutely, yes. He spoke many, many times about ham radio. As a matter of fact, if he, well, you talk about Army stories, part of, you know, being in the military is there's a lot of bureaucracy and paperwork and things like that. So if he was telling a story and he wanted to say that, you know, the lieutenant had to file a form or something, he might call it the 6SJ7GT form. Well, 6SJ7GT was actually a vacuum tube that you would use in a radio set. So that became his sort of blanket serial number.
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, any time he needed one.
Well, the name of the book, and obviously the name of the book is so much tied into Gene Shepard, Excelsior, You Fathead. What's the origin of that phrase?
Well, it was, I guess you could call it sort of like a password, and the other half of that actually is, you played a clip earlier, is Seltzer Bottle, You Slob. And it was sort of like a password and a countersign kind of thing. Excelsior, it sort of means onward and upward, and it's sort of counterbalanced by the fathead part. So it kind of sums up Gene's philosophy. You strive to go ahead, but if you, you know, and I'm sorry, Gene Bergman, I'm stealing this from you, but the fathead part says, well, but if you take this too seriously, you're a dunce. So it has a contradictory meaning, but it pretty much sums up Shep's philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially in regards to the end of life. We're all going to end it sooner or later, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have a very good ending.
Yeah, that's true. And we Shep fans have sort of adopted the fathead part of that. Instead of saying, I'm a Shepherd fan, you say, I'm a fathead, with a capital F.
Of course.
So we refer to each other all the time as fatheads. it doesn't seem flattering to the outside world, but,
no.
You know, it's sort of like an inside joke.
Well, yeah, because especially in regards to, when you look at Shep in regards to Greenwich Village, which we didn't have a chance to talk about, and the kind of things that would go on, the little happenings that went on during the 50s and I guess later on in the 60s it turned into other types of things in the 70s and such. He basically was the kind of individual that I think lived, as mentioned by Gene before, Gene Bergman, living for the now instead of the future. And yet, at the same time, it must have been extremely difficult by the end of his life, seeing that maybe if he would have taken Barry Farber's advice about not necessarily just smiling a little at your bosses, right?
I don't think that would have been something that Shepard would have ever done.
No, I don't think he would have. He absolutely didn't. Because
no.
It's obviously he didn't take Barry's advice on
that. Oh, no. Oh, no. And to a certain extent, yes, he paid the price for that. But, you know, he lived life on his own terms as well.
As we all do.
I don't know how many of us can say that.
Not many. Well, thank you for joining us, Jeff Beauchamp, the Gene Shepard Project, a free service and swap exchange of CDs, MP3s. Their website is coming up soon, and that will be www.thegeneshepherdproject.com. Email, my heavens, what, Shep, MP3 at